Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the impact of political affiliation on our capacity for empathy.
And should moderate Republicans apologize for voting for Trump?
But first, late last week, Vice President Kamala Harris's campaign announced the creation of an advisory board here in Arizona made up of members of an unlikely voting bloc for the Democratic candidate, members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. For a long time, LDS voters have been a reliable Republican vote here, where there are nearly 500,000 Latter-day Saints and across the country. But that picture has begun to change in the era of Donald Trump. Now, especially among some LDS women, we're seeing interest in Kamala Harris. Our next guest heard stories of women putting post-it notes in women's restrooms and churches, reminding them their husbands won't know who they vote for. Kellen Browning is covering the 2024 election in Arizona and Nevada for the New York Times, and I spoke with him more about his reporting in LDS communities in the East Valley.
LDS voters have been Republican for generations. They view their religion and their morals more in alignment with Republicans, and they've voted for Republican candidates in the past. But we have seen since Donald Trump came onto the scene that they have been hesitant to back him, and we saw that a significant portion of Mormon voters in Arizona backed Joe Biden in 2020. So the question now is, can Kamala Harris gain that same kind of support from them?
Right. And this was surprising at the time, and watching that kind of shift away from the Republican Party for some of these voters has been really interesting. Talk a little bit about the reporting you did here, the people you met, and what seems to be swaying these, you know, traditionally Republican and conservative voters away from specifically Donald Trump.
Sure. LDS voters have for years been not thrilled with Donald Trump. I think it's safe to say they have not liked what they view as his character flaws, some of the things he says about immigrants and women, his personality. So they were already drifting away from him to some degree. And this year, it seems like there are some factors that make them more than ever conflicted and unhappy about supporting Donald Trump. They really did not like the criminal cases against him, his involvement in the January 6th Capitol riot. These are all things that felt like they confirmed their worst fears about his character. So they're really wrestling right now with whether to continue supporting a Republican, as they have done traditionally, or to potentially take this leap and back a Democrat, some of them for the first time.
Yeah, some of them for the first time, for sure. Is there, from what you can tell, a gender divide here? Like, I know I've heard a little bit more probably about LDS women being more likely to vote for Harris this time around. Is that true from your reporting?
Yeah, that's what my reporting has found, that there are a number of LDS women in Arizona that feel like there could be a significant gap in support between men and women in the church in terms of who they back this November. Especially because there's this sense from Mormon women that perhaps some of the abortion restrictions that states have put in place since the overturning of Roe v. Wade have gone a little bit too far. And that might be surprising to some people, because Mormon voters have traditionally leaned more conservative. They have been against abortion in many cases, with some exceptions. But there is this feeling from some of the women that I spoke with that, you know, maybe we need to be rethinking things a little bit. Maybe some of these restrictions are just a little bit too much. And there's even this sense, perhaps, that some women might vote for Kamala Harris without their husbands or other people in their life knowing about this.
Right. And there's sort of an underground kind of campaign going on about that, about not having to tell your husband who you vote for, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That just this idea that, you know, maybe it's better not to mention it, not to cause conflict, you know, whether in the community or in their own family. I think the same could hold true potentially for children in the church that might vote for Kamala Harris, and maybe their parents will vote for Trump. And it's just something that they're not going to talk about, and they're just going to go ahead in the voting booth and cast their ballot.
Right. So let's talk about that, because there's also a generational gap here, which is really interesting. You mentioned abortion and women. What does the gap have to do with for Gen Z? Is this about diversity, LGBTQ issues?
Yeah, it's all of those. I spoke with a couple younger LDS voters and also some researchers, and they said essentially that, you know, the church is just getting more diverse. It's getting younger, and there are younger members who have more liberal attitudes on issues like LGBT rights, divorce, abortion, things that may be traditionally skewed more conservative, but these people have more liberal attitudes, and they're potentially bringing their parents and grandparents along with them into this sort of what they view as like a more modern view on society. And that mm-hmm. might include rejecting Donald Trump in favor of Harris.
Okay, so let's talk about the potential impact of this, right? Like, we talked a little bit about the top of the ticket and the shift we've seen there. What about down ballot races? There have also been events where you've seen LDS voters getting together to hear from somebody like Ruben Gallego, who's been for a long time a pretty liberal Democrat.
That's right. First of all, I think it's worth pointing out how potentially significant this population could be in Arizona. At the presidential level, Joe Biden won by just about 10,000 votes, and there are nearly 500,000 members of the church in Arizona, although that number includes children. Mm-hmm. So yes, siphoning off even some small percentage of votes to the Democratic candidates could be significant. Lower down the ballot, yes, Ruben Gallego has made overtures to the LDS community. I know that the Harris campaign is working to do that. So there is this sense that potentially, you know, if you're going to vote for Harris at the top of the ticket, is it possible that you could get them to vote Democratic lower down the ballot? There's a sense from some of the more moderate and liberal LDS members I spoke with that Carrie Lake perhaps shares some of these same personality traits with Donald Trump that they dislike, and they might be voting for Gallego. So, you know, it's hard to say, because also there are plenty of LDS people that certainly still do support Donald Trump. They're going to vote Republican. And maybe they're conflicted and they might leave the top of the ticket blank, but they might still vote Republican down the ticket just because that's what they're used to. And they feel, you know, more comfortable with those sort of traditionally conservative values.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I want to ask you about John Giles here, the Republican mayor of Mesa, Arizona. He came out in support of Harris, had come out in support of Biden before. He is a longtime Republican here in the state. Is there a John Giles effect in these communities? Did you hear about that from folks?
It's a great question. I think to some degree, it breaks down along partisan lines. I spoke with some Republicans who said, John Giles, we already disliked him. You know, we already knew he was liberal or whatever. And people on the Democratic side or the left were happy. So to mm-hmm. some degree, you know, endorsements, how much do they matter is hard to say. But I do think, you know, it's certainly relevant and important to have a prominent Republican in the state come out and so strongly back your campaign if you're Kamala Harris. You know, Mitt Romney even has not done so.
Right.
I think there's this sense, you know, from LDS voters that maybe I don't like Trump, but I'm not sure if I can really go ahead and back Kamala Harris. I might just not vote. I might leave the top of the ticket blank. So for him to come out so strongly, not just in opposition to Trump, but in support of Harris, is significant. He spoke at the Democratic National Convention. I heard him there. Mm-hmm. He spoke at a Harris Walls rally in Arizona a couple weeks ago. And so it certainly doesn't hurt to have someone that's, you know, relatively prominent, especially in the East Valley, be on your side.
Yeah. All right. We will leave it there for now. Kellen Browning, reporter for The New York Times, covering the 2024 election, including here in Arizona and Nevada. Kellen, thank you for coming on. Thanks for your reporting here. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks very much for having me.
In case you haven't noticed, we live in a politically polarized country, with people on both sides framing the upcoming election as a decision with apocalyptic implications. But as hard as it may be to believe right now, there will, in all likelihood, be life after November 5th. So once the electoral dust settles, how will we interact with the people in our lives that we disagree with? For a possible answer to that question, consider the research of Dr. James Casey at the University of Queensland in Australia. As he recently told the show Sam Dingman, he thinks it's possible that our human identities are in danger of being overshadowed by our political ones.
I was thinking about how I know some people who are really passionate about politics. That doesn't describe me myself. I'm a bit more, I have political beliefs, but I don't hold them very strongly.
Okay.
And I sort of admire the people who do hold their beliefs really strongly because they're able to actually fight for changes. But at mm-hmm. the same time, I wondered if there's something about the passion to fight for those beliefs that actually stops you from feeling empathy for people who don't share your own beliefs.
Right. So there are some prevailing notions about politically liberal people and politically conservative people and their relationships to empathy. How would you characterize those prevailing notions that you were aware of prior to the beginning of your research?
Well, you're probably aware of the phrase bleeding heart lefties or bleeding heart liberals.
I am.
And so that the research tends to back this up. We know that if we ask liberals and conservatives how much they value empathy, then liberals will say that they value it much more than conservatives do. And in studies where we look at empathy for particular kinds of people, generally liberals have shown more empathy for those kinds of people than conservatives have.
And so knowing that, tell me about the methodology that you used. If I was to participate in this study, what would my experience have been?
So these studies were all conducted online. So mm-hmm. you would be going through a survey. And part of that survey would be, I would ask you about a person that you're just finding out some new information about. Mm-hmm. And so the information we give you about this person, typically called Jack. So Jack is an American man in his early 30s. He works as an assistant manager in a retail store, and he has a wife and a young child. Now, we then move on to tell you something unfortunate happened to Jack. Mm-hmm. An example would be that he sprained his ankle, and it's quite painful to walk on. He's walking on crutches. And we ask you, how much empathy do you feel towards Jack? And so that's the situation for about a third of the participants. And then a third of the participants have this extra information that Jack is also a Republican, or the final third see that Jack is a Democrat supporter. And so the question for me as a researcher is, how does this additional information about Jack's political beliefs affect how much empathy compared to if you don't know that political information?
So you begin the various studies and you begin to find, quote, in comparisons across participant politics, liberals showed less empathy for outgroup targets, which is to say conservatives, than conservatives showed for outgroup targets, which is to say liberals. So this was a surprising result, was it not?
Yes, absolutely. It contrasts with that idea of the bleeding heart lefties, and it also contrasts with all of the academic research that I'd been looking at prior to these studies.
And it seemed like one of the key factors in the empathy difference in your findings between liberals and conservatives was this idea of perceived harm, right?
Yeah. I asked people, how much do you think this person's political group causes harm to the American people in general, to groups that you value in particular, and to just individuals that you know? Mm-hmm. Because we assume that that transfers to our moral judgments of the individuals who support that party, whether or not those individuals have any control at all over what the party does.
That's really interesting. I mean, one of the things that's fascinating to me about this is kind of the old saw in politics generally is this idea that, well, if we could all just see each other as individuals, we wouldn't have so much division and so much rancor and so much misunderstanding. But here you present this person and you say, like, look, they've got a different political belief than you, but they got a sprained ankle and it's really tough for them to walk around. Isn't that rough? That's exactly the kind of interaction that politicians love to stand behind podiums and tell us we should all aspire to. And yet your research suggests that it might not be all that effective.
Well, I guess the good news from my studies is that it's not as though people were looking at Jack even when he had opposing political beliefs to the participant. Even when we're looking at the opponent, it's not that we have no empathy for them, and it's not that we think they're completely evil. It's that we're just less sure of what to do in that situation.
Yeah. Well, at the end of the study, you speculate a bit about why your findings differ from previous studies. And you suggest that one factor might be a change in what you call group norms. Tell us what you mean by that.
So group norms are rules of behavior within groups, unspoken rules. So it's possible that conservatives have over time developed an in-group rule that they should be a little more tolerant and a little more compassionate, even of liberals. And it's possible that the reverse has happened among liberals, that liberals have started to develop this rule that you should be really strict and critical of your opponents and not as tolerant.
Right. So we began our conversation by having you explain that you were interested in this in part because it was an invitation to yourself to understand the conviction with which people hold their political beliefs and how it informs the way that they engage with others. How did doing this research and conducting these studies affect your own relationship to that? Where are you now, having gone through this process?
It was a little humbling to come through this process. So I started originally feeling like if only people were a little more calm, if only they could dial it back a little bit, then we'd be able to get along and have respect for each other. But on the other end of this research, I think that I was naively ignoring that there are things that political parties do that are absolutely harmful to specific people on the other side. And so it's very naive to expect people who have been harmed to show empathy and restraint and tolerance for the people who are associated with the party who is harming them.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I have a little more of a nuanced expectation.
Perhaps a little bit more empathy question?
A little more empathy. Yeah, yeah. I think I understand their perspective a bit better now.
All right. Well, Dr. James Casey is a researcher at the University of Queensland in Australia. Dr. Casey, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Sam.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a queer writer, historian, and activist from Tucson reflects on their decision to leave for LA in the 1980s and to eventually return over a decade later.
So my intent in writing this book as a brown queer and organizing with other brown queers is to bring that type of activity out, to make sure to document that kind of activity so that it's remembered.
We'll hear more about their new memoir later on the show.
But first,
we have talked a lot on the show about moderate Republicans who are stuck this election cycle, torn between voting for a Republican candidate they do not like and a Democrat they largely do not agree with. But our next guest this morning says there are plenty of good reasons for moderate Republicans to support Donald Trump this election, and they shouldn't be ashamed of it. Phil Boas is a columnist on the opinion pages of the Arizona Republic, and he joins editorial page editor Elvia Diaz this morning to talk more about it. Thanks to you both for coming on. Appreciate it as always.
Good morning.
Good to be here.
All right. So, Phil, I want to start with you and your kind of main argument here. You are a moderate Republican, and if you've read what you've written, you know you're not a giant fan of Donald Trump. So tell us, what's your argument here? Like, why shouldn't Republicans like you apologize for voting for him?
Trump's national populism has been a real conundrum for any of us who have sort of seen ourselves as part of the establishment Republican Party, the old party that has now pretty much disappeared. You know, we've seen a lot of high profile defections from the party and mostly from that establishment wing. For me, though, I might have gone the same way, except we didn't get the left we used to have. And the left had turned more populist, had become more liberal, and had become more of a threat to the things that we value on the right, more hostile to the culture on the right. And so for me, there was a feeling, you know, it was the old Donald Rumsfeld saying, you don't get to pick the army you go to war with. Hmm. And I wouldn't have picked Donald Trump to be the general of this army. But we are in a cultural war with the left if you're coming from the perspective of the right.
Yeah.
And so you have to fight that war. You have to push back. against some of the things that are being done on the left.
Yeah. Let me ask you one follow-up question there that I think is sort of the obvious question in most people's minds when they hear you make this argument from the perspective you're coming from, right? Which is the concern about, you know, preserving democracy, which this election and the last were largely framed around. Do you think Donald Trump is a serious threat to democracy?
I think what happened on January 6th shows that he is a threat to democracy. He played with fire there. He can be a truly foolish man. But I think the Democrats are an enormous threat to democracy. And I would just say this. Imagine the day that Kamala Harris gets in office, Democrats have taken Congress, and then they put in place a plan that Harris has endorsed, and that is to reform the U.S. Supreme Court by imposing term limits that would immediately take out three conservative justices and put in three liberal justices and create basically one-party rule in the country. Imagine how destabilizing that would be. That's a threat to democracy.
Elvia, let me turn to you and your take here, especially beginning with that point about democracy. Do you think that those are, I guess, equal concerns about preserving democracy going forward?
No, they're not. And you know what? One of the things that exasperated me about this column, but also the fact that I liked it because it offers a glimpse into the minds, perhaps, of people voting for Donald Trump. You know, we see the polls that are still very close, very tight. And, you know, in my mind, I just can't fathom the idea of, you know, half the country voting for Donald Trump. So, you know, in reading this column and obviously in talking to Phil on a daily basis, you know, it offers me that perspective and mm-hmm. it offers readers that perspective as well. I do not agree, of course, you know, in almost anything or how he outlines a column here is very interesting. You will see that Phil is saying here, don't apologize for vote Republican. Well, on the surface, of course, I would agree with something like that. It were talking about the old guard Republicans that talk about conservative values, that talk about being fiscally responsible. But we're talking about Donald Trump. We're not talking about Republicans. We're talking about Trump Republicans and a danger to democracy. And we don't have to imagine that. We have already seen what he looks like and what he's capable of. So two different things here, Republicans and Trump Republicans.
Phil, let me turn to you here, because I think one of the more interesting things you say in this column, and you started to make this argument already here, is that both of these candidates are what you call extremists. Talk about where you see the Harris campaign and agenda as extreme.
Well, Kamala Harris, first of all, didn't tell the truth about Joe Biden and wasn't forthcoming about his mental acuity, that he really wasn't fit to carry on as president. And the Democrats covered that up for a long time. And they've kept her in bubble wrap. She's barely said anything. She's running for the most powerful job in the world, and she's not talking to the American people, barely talking to them. And when she finally did come out with an economic plan, she comes out with price controls, which is one of the most proven disasters there could be in economics. When you impose price controls, you create food lines, you create gas lines, as Nixon did in the 1970s that I remember well as a kid. And then on abortion, I mean, we used to be moderate in this country about abortion, but now the Democrats and Harris want to take the most extreme line on abortion. No holds barred, no regulation on abortion, no protection for the unborn, even the viable unborn. And so if you're a Republican and you're looking at this, you think that there are real problems on the left and a real threat on the left.
There's no equivalence here. I will say it almost is a false equivalency. I mean, we have a president whose vision of America is incredibly dark, is gloomy, you know, dividing the country into them versus us. I mean, the former president keeps talking about immigrants eating, you know, the pets in Ohio when it is absolutely not true. What I want to hear also from Trump Republicans Republicans is to imagine how the country will be under a President Trump. You know, we only hear about what a Harris presidency would be because she has actually, you know, put out some policy proposals. I haven't seen that for Donald Trump other than lies and division and rhetoric and, you know, tweets about or his post and his social media in capital letters, you know, saying that women are unhappy and that, you know, they are not sexy because of that. And my goodness, I mean, talk about policy, talk about how he's going to control gas prices. I mean, the only thing that we have gotten clear from him is how he's going to deal with immigration, which is to deport everyone here undocumented, you know, massive deportations. That's it. I haven't heard any real policy positions coming out of his mouth outlining that for Americans and how a presidency will look like under him. I haven't seen that.
Phil, let me ask you about the other side of that, because I asked you about why you thought that Kamala Harris and her agenda were extreme. What about on the other side, looking at, you know, Trump's agenda and what Elvia is pointing out there, like what makes you say, OK, I am OK to vote for this person in this agenda as opposed to, you know, writing someone in or voting for a third party or just not voting at the top of the ticket, as we've heard many kind of moderate Republicans say, I'm going to have to do.
Well, I'm not comfortable at all with my vote. And a lot of the Republicans I talk to are not comfortable with it. I mean, we have real reservations about it. And I think it would have been a lot easier had Joe Biden done what he promised in his inaugural, and that is, had he tried to unite the country. Instead, he pushed out this very left-wing progressive agenda that was an assault on conservative values. So you may have to make a judgment here as a Republican. If the Democrats get control of the federal government again, they're going to set the path so that they control it for the next generation. They want to bring in Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C. as states that would create new Senate seats that are all Democrat, that would make it virtually impossible to get Republican control of the Senate for a very long time. And it could be many, many years before you get, once you, Donald Trump is gone, that you could really begin to get Republican values into the federal government again. So you don't have good choices here. It's the lesser of two evils. And this is a battle we have ongoing. We have this every week on the editorial board. So you're getting a peek of what LV and I argue about every week.
It's an interesting peek. All right, we will leave it there for now. That is Phil Boas, columnist for the Arizona Republic, joining editorial page editor Elvia Diaz this morning. Thank you both for coming on. Thank you both for letting us take a peek inside those arguments. I very much appreciate it.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. The high-level portion of the United Nations General Assembly gets underway tomorrow in New York City as world leaders gather to talk about the issues of importance to them. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin in London. And Jonathan, can you remind us first off what these next few days are all about?
Well, the General Assembly itself has been running for a couple of weeks now, but we're at the business end of the gathering, so to speak, when national leaders start giving their big speeches. Every one of the UN's 193 members gets a chance to speak, plus two non-member observing states, the Holy See and the State of Palestine. And the European Union can also speak as an observer member. Brazil goes first. This is because back in the early days, nobody wanted to do that. Brazil put its hand up, and it's been a tradition since then. Next up is the United States, because the UN building is hosted there. This year, 87 heads of state and 45 heads of government are due to speak, with lower ranked speakers filling out the rest of the schedule. And of course, a lot of the time, what goes on the sidelines is of key interest. The General Assembly is sometimes described as speed dating for national leaders. Speakers are asked to keep to around 15 minutes each for their contributions, though that's often ignored. Cuba's Fidel Castro famously made the longest speech in the gathering's history at 4.5 hours back in the 1960s.
So what sorts of issues are leaders likely to be talking about, either from behind the podium or on the sidelines this year?
Well, there is a theme which the leaders are asked to address. They tend to briefly mention it before moving on to speak about whatever they want. This year, that is leaving no one behind and acting together for the advancement of peace, sustainable development, and human dignity for present and future generations. So quite a mouthful. Beyond that, the war in Gaza is sure to be front and center in many of the contributions. The death toll there has now surpassed 41,000, and I suspect many leaders will be calling for a ceasefire in that conflict. Last year's General Assembly happened just before the October the 7th Hamas attacks on Israel that triggered the war. So this is the first time the General Assembly will be addressing the issue. The recent flare-up of tensions between Israel and Lebanon's Hezbollah in the wake of last week's exploding communications device attacks, Israel's Beirut strike, which killed senior Hezbollah commander Ibrahim Akil, but also killed several children, and then there's been rocket attacks in both directions today, quite deadly ones in southern Lebanon. That's likely to come up. And some regard this whole event as just a talking shop. But as Sudan's civil war rages on, both sides have indicated they're willing to engage in peace talks, just as Sudan's leader is due to address the General Assembly. It's not clear that there's a link, but sometimes it offers a space for progress, though the fighting does continue. And world leaders are also likely to call for an end to the conflict in Ukraine. The General Assembly adopted 6 resolutions on the conflict in the first year, denouncing Moscow and demanding it withdraw all its troops. But that war also rages on. Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky will be addressing the assembly on Wednesday, but Russia's Vladimir Putin is staying away, not least perhaps because he's subject to an international arrest warrant. His foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, will be giving a speech on Saturday, though.
So, Jonathan, you mentioned Volodymyr Zelensky. He'll also be meeting with President Biden while in the U.S. The use of Western long-range missiles against targets in Russia will presumably be at least near the top of the agenda for that meeting?
Absolutely. I mean, by way of background, Ukraine's been repeatedly asking for permission to use these long-range missiles that the West is supplying it with against targets deep inside Russian territory. It says it wants to hit locations from which Russian missiles used against Ukraine are being launched. Just last week, it demonstrated that it can use its own drones to target Russian munitions stores well into Russia, but it really wants to use more powerful weapons there. Britain's Prime Minister Keir Starmer traveled to Washington the week before last and is understood to have been pushing to grant such permission, but the U.S. is more cautious about doing so, with officials recently saying they want more information about how Kyiv would use the weapons and how they fit into the broader strategy of the war. Whilst the missiles at issue in the first instance at least are made by the UK, they rely on US technology for targeting, so US permission is critical. Russia is vehemently opposed to such a move. Vladimir Putin has warned that allowing Ukraine to fire long-range missiles into Russia would amount to direct NATO involvement in war against Russia. Now, some military analysts dismiss that as what they see as Russia's presence than making empty threats. They point out that he said similar things before the West gave Ukraine battle tanks and fighter jets. But there are also plenty of people who caution that Vladimir Putin perhaps should be taken seriously this time around. It's thought there could be movement on a decision over these long-range missiles during the course of this week.
And in addition to his meeting with President Biden, President Zelensky also has a separate meeting scheduled with Vice President Kamala Harris. And he's also hoping to meet with her rival for the U.S. presidency, Donald Trump. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Of course, if Kamala Harris wins the presidential election, U.S. policy towards the conflict in Ukraine is likely to remain fairly similar to how it's playing out at the moment. But the potential impact of a Donald Trump presidency is much harder to predict. Keep in mind that a key aspect of his relationship with Volodymyr Zelensky centers around the first time he was impeached. He was accused in that of breaking the law by pressuring Ukraine's leader in exchange for continuing U.S. support to dig up damaging information on Joe Biden, who was at the time the front runner to face Donald Trump in the upcoming presidential election. That's bound to have an impact on how Donald Trump sees Ukraine's leader. And then at the recent presidential debate between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris, the moderators repeatedly offered Donald Trump the chance to say he wanted Ukraine to win its war against Russia, but the former president simply said he wants the war to stop, which has led to concerns in Ukraine that a re-elected Donald Trump would seek an end to the war on terms much more favorable to Vladimir Putin than the U.S.'s Western allies want to see. So a potentially very high-stakes meeting for Ukraine's president with Donald Trump if that meeting actually ends up happening.
Interesting. Okay, so Jonathan, let's end in your neck of the woods with Britain's governing Labour Party holding its annual conference in Liverpool this week. But it is coming at a tricky time for the new Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Keir Starmer was elected in a landslide on July the 4th, and this conference had been billed as a chance for the party to celebrate that election victory and set out its stall for the coming years. Party conferences happen every year, and they're where political parties decide on their policy priorities and hear from key figures in the party. They practically take over the towns and cities they happen in when they occur. This week's will culminate with Keir Starmer's speech to the party faithful, but it's been a challenging couple of weeks for Keir Starmer and the Labour Party. The government announced it would take away a winter fuel subsidy worth several hundred pounds annually that had been paid to all pensioners and means tested instead, offering it only to poorer pensioners, which has proved to be quite unpopular. And that's had an uncomfortable juxtaposition with recent revelations about gifts from wealthy donors to the tune of thousands of pounds to pay for things like suits, spectacles, concert and football tickets for the Prime Minister, including clothes for his wife. It's damaged his reputation for squeaky clean politics, though there's no suggestion he's done anything illegal. Plus, it was recently leaked that he's approved a pay deal for his top aide in excess of his own salary, which has reportedly upset lower paid advisers, some of whom took a pay cut when they came into government from opposition. Keir Starmer's been forced to defend himself, arguing, for example, that if he didn't accept hospitality tickets to see his beloved Arsenal football team in a box, there'd be a significant cost to the taxpayer in terms of security for him to watch it from the stands. And last week he said he was completely in control despite the damaging series of leaks, though he and other ministers who accepted donations to buy clothes have said they will no longer do that in future. And Keir Starmer's personal approval rating has plummeted to a level similar to that of his predecessor, Rishi Sunak.
Interesting. All right. That is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin in London. Jonathan, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
And you. Thanks, Mark.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Lydia Otero was born in Tucson in 1955 and grew up and went to school there, where they faced discrimination. Otero also says they knew they were queer since they had consciousness. In 1978, Otero decided to leave Arizona and move west.
In the 70s and 80s, it was hard to be queer in Tucson and Arizona. And I found it easier to be a queer activist in Los Angeles.
Otero came back to Tucson in the 90s after living in L.A. for two decades, mainly as an electrician. They're a writer and historian. Their most recent book is called L.A. Interchanges, a Brown and Queer Archival Memoir. I spoke earlier with Otero and asked what it was like going from Tucson to L.A. and what it was like when they first got to California and started figuring out their place there.
Well, it's very a unique story, but maybe it's not, because a lot of people in Tucson have relatives in Los Angeles. And I had relatives in Los Angeles, so I used to spend my summers there. So growing up, I knew that Los Angeles was different. Like, I used to see queers on the bus, and I used to see queers out in the streets more than I did in Tucson. They were more out. They were more identifiable to me. So I always grew up knowing that LA was more friendly to queers, and that LA was a place where you could be queer, whereas in Tucson, I didn't see that as much.
Well, so what was it like sort of dividing your time between your activism and, I guess, for lack of a better word, your day job as an electrician?
Yeah, well, you know, it was a nine to five job, although it really was a 6 to 3 job. And then I'd go home and wash up and then be free to engage in activism in the evenings. Mm. And it worked really well. And also, if you know the construction trades a little bit, you know that jobs come to an end and sometimes you have weeks in between.
Yeah.
And so my book, LA Interchanges, is about that time. So I tried really hard, based on your question, to write a book where it seems like I had a very disjointed life, right? Activist, electrician. The challenge for me was to make it seem more holistic and to connect those narratives to make it seem like it wasn't a disjointed life. Because actually for me, and how I remember it, it flowed pretty harmoniously.
Huh. I'm wondering how much of that connection came down to the fact that you were doing a job that then, and perhaps even still now, was very male-dominated.
Right. Yeah, I wonder, too, because I got to express, you know, I'm a more masculine-leaning, non-binary individual now. So I got to play out those those tendencies of building and making, of wearing a tool belt, carrying heavy things, and then seeing your labor as a building, as a structure. I don't think that too many female-bodied people back then, or women, got to see the fruits of their labor in that way, the way that males did. So it was very empowering to do that. And it was, even in the early 80s, the guys on the job site knew that I was queer. But I was in a union, and I think that changed things. Because the electricians around me were very invested in ensuring that I was safe, in terms of safe, not just because of queerness, not that, but I was safe working with electricity, that we always took care of ourselves and that we always looked after each other. So I didn't encounter any homophobic comments or actions from the electricians. Now, the other trades, the laborers, the steel workers, the carpenters, they did try to harass me, or they did harass me, not just try. But I always felt very much like I fit in to our local and to our union, and I felt very comfortable with them.
It's interesting what you say about seeing the fruits of your labors, because it seems like there's a juxtaposition there between, you know, being an electrician where, you know, at the end of every day, or at least at the end of every job, you can tangibly like stand back and look at what you have done and see it and appreciate it. Whereas as an activist, it can be a little more nebulous. It seems like it might take a little bit longer, or the progress might not be quite as obvious.
Right, right. And the point of me writing this book is that if you look at the history of queer activism in Los Angeles, you really see the more important figures, right? The gay men who were friends with President Clinton, those that started these national institutions, or those that rallied and were friends with the governor who had political connections. So my intent in writing this book as a brown queer and organizing with other brown queers is to bring that type of activity out, to make sure to document that kind of activity so that it's remembered.
Well, so what was it like for you? I guess what went into your decision then to ultimately move back to Tucson? Because as you say, you had been there, you went to LA where you were able to really express yourself and, you know, explore who you were and be who you were. So what led you to go back to Tucson?
Well, the 1984 earthquake, the Northridge earthquake, I was working on a job as an electrician at the Coliseum. And that's where USC played their football games.
Right.
And at that time, the Raiders were also playing there, using the field. And we were working on a job that it had to be ready for football season. So we were working long hours, working 7 days. And I suffered a severe job injury. And so at that point, and this was in 1994, at that point, I had to do something where I didn't have to use my body.
Mm.
And I had gone back to school. I had gotten a bachelor's degree. I was in the middle of getting a master's degree in history. So it just seemed to fit that I just got a master's degree in history. And at that point, my mother was getting sick in Tucson. She was developing a form of dementia. Mm. And so I applied to the PhD program in history in Tucson and was accepted. And I was thinking, what job can I get in Tucson? I can't be an electrician there, and I don't really know how to do anything else. And luckily, I got accepted into the program. And once I got my PhD, my research specialty is on urban renewal here in Tucson. And I got an offer for a position as a tenured professor here in 2003. So, of course, I'm going to. Everything seemed to fall into place in a way, but it kind of went in a zigzag kind of way.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look back at my life, it seemed like everything had this like magical sequence to it, but then it didn't. So I just consider myself fortunate, embrace what I can, and just like, you know, it's I've had a fruitful life.
Yeah.
And that's why I write memoirs.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Lydia, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for your questions, too.
Lydia Otero is a writer and historian born and raised in Tucson. Her latest book is called L.A. Interchanges, a Brown and Queer Archival Memoir. Legendary Phoenix Suns radio play-by-play broadcaster Al McCoy passed away on Saturday. He was 91 years old. McCoy was the voice of the Suns for 51 seasons, according to the team, the longest-tenured team broadcaster in NBA history. His first game was in September of 1972. His last was in May of last year. Over those years, he became known for signature catchphrases and memorable calls.
1 second remaining in the second overtime. Here's Perry. To Gar Hurd. Here's the jump shot. Good! It's good! It counts! Gar Hurd ties it! We'll go to the third overtime. I gotta take a breather. I want to tell you something. Somebody up there is on our side.
Pippen on the shot. Did not get it. Rebound West. We will go to the third amazing overtime. Tied. The Suns won 14. Chicago won 14.
Kidd has the ball. Kidd waiting. Kidd
probably the most recognized is the Shazam.
Oh! Shazam! He got it!
I used to read comic books when I was growing up on that farm in Iowa, and one I liked was Captain Marvel. And a young radio reporter named Billy Batson became Captain Marvel when he said, Shazam!
Put up a three. Shazam!
For one last time, this is Al McCoy saying thanks for being there, thanks for being with us tonight, and from the Footprint Center here in downtown Phoenix, we'll just say so long for now.
Al McCoy is survived by his three sons, seven grandchildren, and six great-grandchildren.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Be sure to join us tomorrow morning with much more. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.